from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Wednesday when President Joe Biden ignored the critics and took a meeting with Russian leader Vladimir Putin. They spent several hours together, and Biden emerged to declare that they had made some progress, even if he had won few concessions, if any. Putin was unflinching when he spoke to reporters, offering no sign that his stance, for example, on imprisoning dissidents or political opponents would change. Alexei Navalny, of course, remains locked up. President Biden bristled when pressed to explain what really had changed from all of this. His point was that this is a process that will not change like the flipping of a light switch. Imagine as a dimmer switch, a slow build from dark to light, perhaps. But clearly the critics doubt that there's any brightening happening whatsoever. So what did we learn this week? Our guest are here to help us digest what we saw and what we heard. And Randy Stone is the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. It's really nice to see you back in here.
It's good to see you, Evan.
So I want to start with what, for example, there's many critics, but Masha Gessen was writing in The New Yorker that, you know, some observers would have been counseling him not to do this at all, whether it was Kasparov or even members of Biden's inner circle. She writes, some Russia experts have argued that the summit shouldn't have happened. Biden was in a bind, one familiar to Americans from the 4 years of the Trump presidency. He couldn't avoid giving Putin a big, legitimizing platform, end quote. Did you want to see him take this meeting? Would you have advised against it?
I would have advised against it. I was very skeptical about this from the outset. I thought that the relations between Russia and the United States had to deteriorate for a while in order to get better.
They had to deteriorate.
They had to deteriorate for a while.
Why do you say that?
I think they probably still will, because there are a lot of things that Putin has gotten away with that he never got punished for. And starting with interfering in the 2016 election, getting away with it, then having the Trump administration claim that it hadn't happened, and so on. The Russian leadership was really disappointed in the Trump administration. It didn't deliver, as they thought, on all the promises that they thought they were going to get out of a friendly administration.
Or an acquiescent administration.
Right. I mean, Trump was just too erratic for them. And in the end, they weren't so sure that it had really been a good bet to get a totally unpredictable character like Trump in the White House. But the reaction to the 2016 meddling that should have happened was delayed by 4 years. And then didn't really happen, all right? So, and then there's been a series of other things like poisoning Russian citizens abroad, poisoning Alexei Navalny, locking him up, escalation of tensions with Ukraine and so forth, where one would have liked to see the new administration draw a line, try to create some stronger incentives. And so it's interesting that they decided not to do that. My sense is that there was a lot of opposition within the administration to having this meeting take place. Biden was really determined to do it. And I think he believes in face-to-face diplomacy. I mean, he said publicly, there's no substitute for meeting face-to-face. And that since there's only one decision maker in Russia, which is Putin, he's the one you have to talk to, and that he hoped that a first step towards de-escalating the crisis, normalizing relations a little bit, would be a face-to-face meeting.
I don't want to spend too much time talking about the Trump administration, but let me at least ask for the president's supporters, of which there remain tens of millions in this country ready to vote for him again. Is it a mark in his column to hear analysts say, look, his erratic behavior ended up being a problem for Russia and maybe was a strength? Was that a strength?
I wouldn't go that far. I don't think that there was really a strategy behind Trump's various moves. It's interesting that he took some risks that the Obama administration didn't want to take with respect to Ukraine, giving them anti-tank missiles, for example, which the Obama administration really worried that that would escalate the conflict and Russia would react in a very violent way to that. Trump did it and Russia didn't really blink. So that's interesting. No, I don't think there was a strategy.
Okay. And were there gains during the 4 years of the Trump administration vis-a-vis Russia in terms of what we would have wanted to get out of that relationship? Were there gains?
No. I mean, I think Russia escalated its cyber war with the United States during that time. And it helped that the American president was denying it was going on. And so it just made it very difficult for our law enforcement and intelligence agencies to respond effectively because they were being hamstrung at every turn. So, I mean, this sort of cyber campaign that Russia's been waging is on three different tracks. One is on social media, where initially it was fabricating things and spreading them around. In 2016, they've become more sophisticated. So now they tend to take things that are already in the U.S. social media sphere and they amplify them in a very sophisticated way. So they're spending tens of millions of dollars a year to try to amplify all the conflicts in our society about gun control, about race relations.
Stoking the culture wars, so to speak.
That's right. And doing it from all directions, mm-hmm. right? So if you see something that seems really crazy coming from the right or from the left, you have to wonder, would I have seen this on my social media feed if it weren't being amplified by Russian intervention? It's not that it wasn't written by some crazy American, right? There are plenty of them, but they're making everything worse. The second thing is ransomware, right? We've seen that escalate dramatically.
Can you explain that a little bit, you know, for me? But for anybody who's really struggling to understand exactly what's happening here.
How it works? Well, it's a sophisticated hacking operation, which lays its seeds over the course of years and years, gets into software and gets into backdoors and so forth. And then they seize up the data of some vulnerable operation. Usually they're hospitals, sometimes local governments. Dramatically recently, the pipeline that feeds the eastern United States was held ransom. They held up the pork industry, I think it was last month. It's possible it's because our economy is now so dependent on the internet and on information technology, it's possible to just paralyze things.
That's why it's called ransomware, that it has control of a system and can extract a price simply to not shut it down?
Right. And so I've got your data. If you want your data back, pay me 75 bitcoins, because that was the mm-hmm. that was the price for the pipeline to the northeast, and so that comes to some $4.5 million, and the pipeline company paid the money. Now the FBI subsequently tracked it down and got most of the bitcoin back. It turns out that bitcoin are traceable, but
which you would think would lessen the steam of the allure of that particular crypto, because there's so much crypto, so many flavors of crypto, and there are some that are less traceable, but still bitcoin plugs away.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange world.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. The bitcoin enthusiasts say, see, it's safe after all. You shouldn't be hounding us.
Yeah, right. They're saying it's not just all dark money,
right?
You know, for these nefarious purposes. Okay.
Right.
So that's the second. Is there a third?
Well, the third is hacking, like the SolarWinds hack, mm-hmm. Which didn't have any overt and obvious economic motive, and there was no sort of ransomware demand connected to it. But it gave Russian intelligence backdoors into a lot of American corporations and the federal government. So that's a long-term game. It's believed that whereas the ransomware attacks are done mostly by private groups, the one that did the pipeline is called DarkSide. which are closely associated with Russian intelligence and protected by Putin, and encouraged by them, sometimes overtly. He said that, one fine day they wake up and they have a creative idea, right? they're entrepreneurs. But the SolarWinds hack is believed to have been done by the SVR, which is the Russian, the external branch of what used to be the KGB. So that's Russian intelligence, and they're sort of laying the groundwork for the next big thing they want to do.
The last point on that is there a worst-case scenario you see in that certainly there are highly skilled American hackers and specialists who are, I presume, trying to understand and combat this. But if we are not successful, either in stopping it or in punishing it, as you say, sort of dealing with what's already happened, what's a worst-case scenario?
Well, I guess I'm not too worried, actually, about that last bit, the hacking part. Mm-hmm. I think that U.S. industry will adapt. The government is always going to be behind industry. I mean, the first line of defense is Microsoft. Google and Amazon have been really important players in this, and to a lesser degree, Facebook. But, the U.S. Multinationals are much more effective than the U.S. government in terms of cyber defense. Now, the U.S. government has a lot of, we think, has a lot of very potent tools that it could use, but they basically hold them back because you don't want to reveal them. They become less effective once they're used. And frankly, they're holding those in case there's a nuclear war.
Let me get back to what Masha Gessen said in The New Yorker about whether this meeting should have been taken at all and perhaps the danger in thinking you can gain something from this. Gessen writes, quote, "It isn't rocket science, according to Joe Biden. Look, guys, I know we make foreign policy out to be this great, great skill that somehow is sort of like a secret code," he said. "All foreign policy is a logical extension of personal relationships. It's the way human nature functions." And so, Gessen writes, "Imagine that one of the residents of your apartment building is a monster. He gets into brawls, abuses his own children, throws trash out his window, and sets off fireworks in the wee hours of the night. You've tried talking to him, you've gone to the police, but nothing has had an impact. You've excluded him from community spaces. This, too, has failed to change his behavior, but at least you didn't have to see him all the time. Still, you know that he smokes in bed, increasing the risk that his giant stockpile of fireworks will explode. It seems you have to talk to him, if only to try to persuade him to store his fireworks more safely, and to ensure that he lets you in if you knock. Unavoidably, even talking to him implicates you morally in his monstrous behavior," end quote. What do you make of that set of metaphors there?
I think that's a great analogy, actually. Putin's behavior is monstrous in all sorts of ways. I mean, a few years ago, you could say he was a pretty benign autocrat. He's become less and less benign, right? He's really ratcheted up the repression domestically. A few years back, you could make an argument that he was really interested in global stability, right, in terms of security, that he really wasn't interested in creating unpredictable, dangerous situations. But that's not really the case anymore. And he's amplifying instability all over the place in order to get some leverage. He's a problem that you have to manage somehow. I guess the question for the Biden administration was, in the short to medium term, which is to say the rest of this term, mm-hmm, that Biden has, are we going to get more chaos coming out of Moscow if we make some concessions to him and give him the things he wants, or if we punish him for the things he's done in the past and try to draw red lines? And I think the calculation was that a lot of his misbehavior is driven by domestic politics, right? So the missing piece of the analogy is that this monstrous guy is doing it to impress somebody. And if he is, if he doesn't feel pushed into a corner, then he's less likely to escalate in Ukraine. Right? Because Ukraine, taking over the rest of Ukraine is not in his interest. That would be really costly. It would be a lot of headaches. It would be a miserable guerrilla war for the foreseeable future, and eventually Russia would retreat in humiliation. So that's not something that he would want to do, although in the short run it could make him look like he was really strong because, of course, militarily Russia could roll over the Ukrainian resistance if it chose to. But he could be pushed into doing something like that if he felt sufficiently insecure, right? And similarly, his treatment of dissidents in Russia is going to be much more severe and repressive if he feels more threatened domestically. Right? So ironically, it's the fact that he's less popular at home than he was a few years ago, and that there's a real threat now, right, that street protests could get out of control if he doesn't repress them sufficiently, right? That is causing him to be more repressive now. So it could be the case that pushing him into the corner actually makes things considerably worse, and that giving him the one thing he craves, right, is international prestige and recognition. If he can bask in the glow of meeting with the American president and come away saying, "I didn't make any concessions," means there are a lot of other nastier things he doesn't have to do in order to solidify his political base.
So is it that Joe Biden is thinking, okay, fine, give him that. Let him walk away from this meeting and peacock around a little bit and get the headlines that he wants and claim that he's the tough guy who didn't give in. Give him that. Because that's about stoking his ego, but at least it keeps him off the really dangerously wild stuff that he could be doing.
I think that's exactly the strategy, right?
There's a distinction here. That could be the result of what happened. Do you think that is exactly what President Biden is going for here? Or do you think he thinks, I'm going to get in the room with this guy, and finally he's going to be with like a reasonable actor after 4 years, and he's going to see it differently, and we're going to make progress?
I really don't think Biden expected to get anything out of this summit. And if you thought you were going to get something out of the summit, you would negotiate it ahead of time, right? You would have the documents ready to sign. There would be some deliverables. The only deliverables from this summit were their ambassador is going to get to go home, and our ambassador is going to go back to Moscow, though neither of them was actually kicked out officially, right? So that's not a big change, but it's a slight warming of relations. And they formed a couple of working groups, including one about cybersecurity. That's moderately encouraging, but we don't expect to get any progress in that working group. It's going to be repeating the old mantras. We're going to keep saying, you got to stop doing all this terrible stuff. They're going to keep claiming that they didn't do it. And they're going to say, well, you know what cybersecurity really is about giving us the keys so that we can crack down on our dissidents. That discussion has been going on for, at least all the way through the Obama administration about cybersecurity, and it's not going to change.
It really does strike me that this dealing with Russia is the ultimate in no good choices. You know, right? Like there's just no good choices that you could make here. No easy, obvious, purely moral or sort of high ground or best case. It's a lot of bad choice or bad options, I would say. Choosing the least bad option is a difficult call. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get to some phone calls in a moment here. And coming up here, we will talk a little bit more about Alexei Navalny. And also, the New York Times was writing about how Joe Biden went in clearly with a strategy of saying, we're not putting any red lines on the table. And I'm curious to know what Professor Stone thinks about that approach to this. But before we do that, let me get Adam in Newark on the phone. Hi, Adam. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. It's a pretty current event, right? And I think the Biden approach is going to be more professional and a little more less for PR for himself. But I found it very interesting when Putin was able to spin his Navalny take on, well, here's a man in my country who is causing things like your seditionists coming to your capital, and you're going to lock them up because they had political voice, and he has an opinion that I don't agree with and is stirring up. We don't want that in our country. That was pretty interesting. I think that might be the one thing he gets to run with. But I'd also just like to recommend a couple books. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of one of them, The Perfect Weapon by David Sanger. That came out a few years ago. The current state of cyber warfare is really unwritten. The rules of war. I almost think that Biden is trying to bring this approach to it and say, like, all right, all the countries need to decide what's going to be an act of war here, cyber-wise. And then the other was a book called Stronghold by a woman named Tucker Malarkey. It's about a man who is involved with wild salmon habitat and restoration, especially in the Alaska, Russia, Kamchatka area. The book really shows you a little insight into Russian culture as opposed to just the politics. And it was really great, kind of optimistic, but at the same time, hopeless in the point that Russia is a place where the citizens are lost. And a lot of them try to live as what they can, but it's such a huge place that regions exist without nearly any oversight. And the book was great. So, well, good conversation.
Yeah, let's Adam, thank you. Thanks for the recommendations, Adam. And Professor Stone, you want to add any recommendations for listeners who really want to understand whether it's Russia, the Putin leadership, or related issues?
Gosh, there's no simple way to understand Russia. It's taken a lifetime, and I still don't think I understand it. But let me get back to you with some suggestions. I wanted to react to one thing that the caller said about Putin's spin on Navalny. This has been called in the U.S. press whataboutism.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's something that Russia watchers are familiar with. It's been going on, was a standard playbook for the Soviet Union to point out that, well, you know, the United States has its problems. And it's always been true. Right. So I remember when the Soviet Union collapsed, and I was talking to friends in the early 90s. They wondered, well, which of the things that we were told about the United States are really true? I mean, you don't really have racism in the United States, do you? You don't really have poverty in the United States, do you? I had to point out that, well, no, actually, we do have those problems. So a lot of the things you were told were true. The question is, what's the implication? So, it is a remarkable case of that, right? That Putin says that poisoning his main political dissident and then locking him up and allowing him to almost die in prison is somehow justified because there are crazy people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th in the United States.
And in fact, he traced it to Black Lives Matter demonstrations. So when Putin was pressed on Alexei Navalny, he didn't say, well, let's talk about Alexei Navalny. He said, well, look at the United States here. I mean, look what happens when there's dissent and anger. And quoting from ABC News now, he said, quote, we saw disorder, destruction, violations of law. We feel sympathy with the USA, but we don't want that to happen on our territories. I mean, it is the master of what about, well, what about your country? Look what happened there. All I'm doing is making sure we don't have the same result here. You know, poor Alexei Navalny is in prison, but it's important the greater good is being served. Mm-hmm. He's sort of weirdly a master at that.
Well, and it strikes a chord with the Russian population because they are worried about instability. And, you know, even liberal intellectuals in Russia are really worried about the specter of civil war. You know, they remember enough what domestic instability looks like.
So there's a real lever that he's pulling here. It's not just a deflection. So he doesn't have to talk about Navalny. It's sort of a warning to people in his own country. Now let's talk a little bit about Navalny. No surprise, that he didn't budge an inch on that. Mm-hmm. But Biden seemed. Well, let me go ahead and read then from where the Times talked about Biden and no red lines here because Navalny's part of that. They write, quote, negotiations necessarily begin with establishing the interlocutors' respective positions, making them instantly normal. Consider Navalny. Biden did not demand Navalny's immediate release. He demanded only that he not be killed in prison. Consider Ukraine. Biden didn't demand that Russia withdraw from the parts of the country it has occupied, but only asked that Russia work within the framework of the Minsk Agreement, a series of ceasefire agreements that would not necessarily return the occupied territories to Ukraine. Georgia, another country where Russia has occupied about a fifth of the territory, didn't figure in either president's account of their conversation. The very act of drawing red lines legitimizes the status quo. Let's start on Navalny there. So the idea being, Biden didn't go in and say, you got to free this guy. He said he better not die in prison. Is that as far as Biden could have gone there, you think?
I don't think that it was plausible, right, that Putin would release Navalny. I think, Navalny released a really interesting film on YouTube when he went back to Russia, and really quite high production value. It's very, very long. I watched about an hour of it, but it was sort of deeply offensive and very personal for Putin, and I don't think he's going to forgive that. I just don't think that there's any way that he's going to ever let that go. So I think Biden was being pragmatic. You know, what can we and what can't we expect to achieve? Putin doesn't really want Navalny to die in prison, I think. And so that probably was something that was acceptable to him.
Navalny seems to me to be someone resigned to his fate in some ways. And willing, I mean, I don't know where if your read is sort of as, if you see him as either sort of idealistic or altruistic as perhaps those with less skill in reading the situation do, like people like me. But boy, he seems like someone who is resigned to his fate, has been remarkably courageous, and is very unlikely to ever be a free man again, mm-hmm. will probably die in some way at the hands of this government, if not dying in prison. How do you see him?
Well, I think he is tremendously courageous and idealistic, I think, is right. I think he went back to Russia expecting that he wouldn't survive the trip.
Yeah, not naive, right? I don't think he was naive about
that. No, I don't think he was naive about that. And I think it's part of why he didn't pull any punches when he went back. He made it. He laid all of his cards on the table. I think he and his supporters may be a little naive in their expectation that the Russian regime is fragile enough that it could be overthrown by public pressure. Who knows? They might turn out to be right. Revolutionaries usually have a little bit of idealistic distortion, and sometimes they accomplish things that don't seem like they're possible. And anybody who's lived through the fall of the Berlin Wall has to be cautious about saying that, well, this dictatorship won't fall because it's too strong. But the Putin regime seems to be awfully well entrenched, and all of the successful color revolutions in the former Soviet space have been successful because the government was sufficiently discredited with the armed forces and the security services that they weren't willing to fight for it. And that's not the case with the Putin regime. I mean, he still has strong support in rural areas and with the armed forces. So it doesn't seem likely to me that a political change is imminent.
Talking to Randy Stone, the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Let's take our only break of the hour. I'll take a little bit more of your feedback in our second half hour. So if you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. we'll talk a little bit more about the other red lines that were not drawn and what Professor Stone thinks about the Biden administration's strategy there. Remember, Professor Stone said at the outset of the hour he would have advised Biden not to take this meeting at all, and feels like this relationship with Russia, or at least with Putin, probably has to get worse before it gets better for a lot of reasons. So a very precarious spot here, and we'll talk more about that on the other side here. Coming up in our second hour, the federal government is marking Juneteenth as a federal holiday for the first time. Officially, it's tomorrow. It's being observed federally today. So what do we think about the move to make it a federal holiday? What about its celebration in Rochester? Or at least, maybe celebration's the wrong word. Honoring, remembering, memorializing Juneteenth has gone back several decades. We'll tell you about some things happening this year, next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I was briefly during the break talking to Professor Stone about, you know, Alexei Navalny's hunger strike. And one thing occurred to me in that, was that the only way for him to gain any leverage back? If it's true, as you say, that Vladimir Putin does not want him to die in prison, a hunger strike, I mean, he could have died. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of expectation that he was about to die. Was that the only way for him to gain a little leverage back?
Well, he is in a position of complete powerlessness, right? So, and I don't think that he necessarily has even the power to end his own life at this point. He's they'll put him on artificial nutrition and hydration before that happens, I think. But yes, I think that was an effort to try to make it clear to his captors that he's not going to comply with them. They're going to be responsible for whether he lives or dies.
On the subject of the other red lines that the New York Times was writing about, do you agree with that analysis that it looks like Joe Biden went into this meeting saying, I'm not going to draw any lines in the sand. You know, we're not going to put any sort of unenforceable, you know, machoistic attempts at drawing these lines. And that's what he did, that he carried through this with clearly some preferences on what happens with Ukraine, Navalny, but there weren't red lines.
Yeah, I think that's right. With somebody like Putin, if you draw a red line, you're daring him to step across it. Mm-hmm. And Putin is almost compelled to do so. The other thing is that, particularly with Ukraine, what has worked best in improving Russia's relations with Ukraine is the United States stepping back from commitments, right? Whereas the more committed the United States becomes to Ukraine, the more threatening that is to Russia, right? And therefore, they become more aggressive. Ironically, the United States had nothing to do with the event that you know, that catalyzed the whole Ukraine crisis. It was the European Union signing a trade agreement with Ukraine. But Russia even saw that as being so threatening that, mm-hmm. you know, upped the ante and then led to a whole series of events.
So let me get a little bit of feedback. Marv writes, Joe Biden was vice president when the Obama administration drew a red line with Syria, and he has learned from that. Do you think so?
Well, that is an example that, you know, has often been cited, you know, and it's interesting there that Obama's decision to back down in that case, I think, did show a certain kind of courage because he paid a political price for backing down after having made a threat, right? But he was able to negotiate a deal, which at least at the time seemed like it was a really good one, that involved Putin, right? So Putin helped to negotiate the destruction of a lot of Syrian chemical weapons. And then, of course, it turned out they had more and they produced more and so forth. And in the long run, the deal doesn't look as impressive as it did at the time, right? But in the short run, it was remarkable. They destroyed huge numbers of tons of chemical weapons in that agreement.
And in your analysis there, I mean, what I appreciate about the analysis of what the Obama administration did is that way too often there's like this schoolyard idea that, well, you drew this line, So there's no going back now. You know, you made this threat. And I think the Obama administration, probably President Obama, realized it was a threat that should not have been made. But following through on the threat was more of a problem than just taking the political hit of saying, okay. And then, of course, that opened the door for all of his political detractors in commentating circles to say, well, now no one will respect him because they know he never follows through, which is, of course, was silly. So I agree with you that there was some courage to say it was the wrong thing to do to draw this line and we're not going to follow through in that, because there could have been real disaster at quite a large scale there. Couldn't there have been?
Well, at that point, we would have been pulled into another full-scale war in the Middle East.
Yes.
And we had
Which is like, I'm like, what are we rooting for here? For all the people who said, well, you drew that line.
That's right. We had two of these full-scale wars ongoing at the time in Afghanistan and Iraq, and this would have been three. There wasn't any stomach for that, but now we've also seen that, you know, none of these wars in the Middle East ever end well. And so extricating yourself from them is incredibly painful and difficult. You don't ever accomplish anything that has any lasting value. And in the meantime, all of your capabilities are mortgaged to this one particular liability. Mm-hmm. So to take an example, the U.S. Engagement in Afghanistan mm-hmm. required that we be able to support it logistically. We couldn't do that through Pakistan because we couldn't get Pakistan to cooperate. So one of the major accomplishments of the reset with Putin in the Obama administration was allowing logistical supply to go through Russian and former Soviet space to Afghanistan. So they were cooperating with us very substantially. In fact, most of the physical material that was being sent to our bases was going on Russian railroads. Remarkable cooperation. But this is an example of how once you make a commitment, you've then mortgaged your fate. So your relationship with Russia depends upon the decision you made about Afghanistan, and often becomes the tail wagging the dog.
Yeah. So thank you, Marv, and perhaps Joe Biden would dissent from the idea that it's all just about the lessons of the Syrian line in the sand. But clearly, I think that we are seeing a hesitance to draw such lines right now. Kathy writes to say it was reported last year that Putin had Parkinson's disease, which can cause emotional changes, irritation, anger, paranoia. Does your guest have any sense if something related to that can be happening?
I have no idea. And I'm a little bit skeptical about the long-distance diagnoses. We don't see very much of Putin. He does do these extended press conferences. We saw a little bit of that this week. He really enjoys answering questions from the press, and he does it really well. I mean, I think he has a skill at this. It maybe doesn't come across too well in translation, and in the American context, some of his answers sound wooden and strange, and you know, is really odd to us. But he expresses himself really well in Russian, and you know, he's very articulate. I think he's very persuasive to most Russians. He speaks in a way that's kind of splits the difference between folksy and sophisticated. I mean, he sounds intelligent without sounding like he's a member of the elite, which is a nice skill to have. I don't think everybody has that. And so he's an effective communicator. So I guess I don't see him as somebody, who's really declining.
And perhaps that paves the way for an answer to an email from a listener named Andrew, who is just asking, what are the Russian people's opinion of Navalny? So let's broaden that from Andrew's point. Do we know generally what the sort of the Russian street, what they think of Navalny? And given how persuasive you said Putin can be, what are his own sort of popularity ratings like right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, Russia has had a very active public opinion survey industry, but it's gradually become more and more controlled by the state. And so how much you can trust any of this data is an interesting question. I think it's definitely true that Putin was wildly popular, and definitely true that his popularity has declined. Exactly what that figure is, he's going to go to great lengths to obscure. Part of the reason that authoritarian leaders hold elections is it allows them to obscure how unpopular they are, right? So they cheat, right? It comes in the form of ballot box stuffing. It comes in the form of, particularly in Russia, in the form of not allowing anybody who seems remotely credible to be an opponent candidate. They use all sorts of mechanisms, sort of clientelistic mechanisms, to get all the workers in the factory to show up and vote, and not really to trust the secret ballot and so forth. So, everybody knows that they're cheating, and yet he wins overwhelmingly, and so it leaves you with some uncertainty about whether he's really popular or not. And as long as you're not sure, you're reluctant to move against him. And it deters everybody. It deters the military. It deters the intelligence services. Deters potential opposition candidates, mm-hmm. And deters individuals from going out on the street and protesting. Right. So, it's now the case that something like 2/3 of the authoritarian countries in the world hold elections, and they found that this is a remarkably effective strategy. And Putin is a master of it, keeping us guessing.
But how do they like Navalny?
Well, I think opinions differ widely about Navalny. He's much more popular than he used to be. He's a very sympathetic character, given his courage, the way he's been victimized. I think Russians
poison clearly. I mean, there's no plausible deniability in
And there was
the
no
to poison him.
Right. There was no attempt to deny it, because mm-hmm. you used a kind of poison, that only the KGB ever had access to. Right. It's a nerve agent with a signature, and then you let him out of the country so that they could check to make sure that it really was this particular kind of nerve gas that was used on him, and so forth. Or I guess it's not a gas; it was put in his underwear. Right, so that Putin likes to do that, to use these exotic poison weapons, not because that's the only thing that's available, but because it's a way of signing his name. And so he was trying to make it clear that this he's gone beyond a certain point, and that's unacceptable.
So the Russian people, though, we can't speak necessarily monolithically about their view of Navalny.
I think that there's a really widespread sympathy for him. And sense that he's being treated badly, that he's very courageous, that really resonates with Russians. I think before this episode, he became much more popular actually during the early stage of COVID. His the reach of his social media and so forth became much, much greater, and that was why he was seen as a threat. Before that, he was, kind of a curiosity, and he had some odd views. He had been a little contradictory about what his positions were. In recent years, he'd been focusing on the issue of corruption, and that's something that Russians care about. Right? They have a sense that the system is corrupt, and they're pretty annoyed about that. So that resonates.
You brought up nuclear war earlier this hour, and I have like this really dark, I don't know if belief is the right word. It's sort of a belief. It's a concern that our civilization will be marked by a period of relative stability now, and a series of nuclear events. If a nuclear weapon goes off in a major world city, it is inevitably going to, well, it seems almost inevitable that it would lead to the deployment of more such weaponry and an escalation. I mean, I have no idea how many pieces of nuclear weaponry are out there and how well contained they are. Can you give us a sense for the challenge here in knowing what's out there and what Russia has done to secure or not this? And do you share this concern that, you know, that we will, I don't know, hopefully not in our lifetimes, but at some point we could see something really catastrophic still?
Well, you know, I was really worried about nuclear war breaking out in the 1980s. And I think there was a time, I think Russian experts would point out they had a war scare in the early 1980s that we weren't even aware of at the time in the United States. They thought that the United States was preparing to strike first during the first Reagan administration. I think that the risk of nuclear war was reduced dramatically at the end of the Cold War, and it hasn't ever gotten back to the level that it had reached during the Cold War. And the highest risk, of course, was the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? And we came very, very close to a nuclear war at that point, though at a much lower level of armaments even than we have today. After the end of the Cold War, there were a series of nuclear arms reduction treaties. The most recent one, the New START treaty, which was just reaffirmed in the first weeks of the Biden administration bilaterally with Russia, reduced nuclear arsenals. They had been at roughly 10,000 warheads on each side at their peak, and their I think I had the figures last time I talked to you, but maybe 1,500 now. So it's categorically different, right? So there was a time when if all of those nuclear missiles were fired and they all landed somewhere, it would have wiped out, you know, certainly all human civilization, and you know, maybe would have wiped out all the vertebrates. We now have much reduced arsenals. So it's not that kind of cataclysmic event, though it would still be absolutely catastrophic for human civilization.
But I think I'm less concerned about, you know, firing missiles at states firing missiles at one another versus a rogue weapon showing up in a briefcase somewhere in a major population center.
Yeah, I don't think that's likely to happen.
Okay.
I think it's actually
I'm
a lot
glad
harder.
To hear that.
I think it's a lot harder for terrorists to get a hold of nuclear weapons than that. I think there was a time in the early 90s when there was enough chaos in the former Soviet Union that there was a real concern about that.
And I don't bring this up just because, I mean, like, I haven't watched the show 24 in years, you know, which the Kiefer Sutherland Fox vehicle, which made you think that everybody in the world could be walking around carrying a suitcase. I'm just was more concerned about sort of lax policy of containment. But
well, and actually, one positive there is that Russia is spending a lot more in the military than they were, and so their ability to to police themselves is much better than it was in the 1990s.
Okay, last couple of minutes. What you wouldn't have advised President Biden to take the meeting. He took this meeting. If you got his ear next, how would you like to see them at least proceed with either relationship building, extracting what we need out of this relationship, et cetera?
Well, I guess what I hope is that things don't deteriorate a lot. I'd like.
But you said they have to deteriorate before they get better.
The best that seems likely at this point is that the situation in Ukraine doesn't get a whole lot worse. I guess I don't expect that we're likely to get a modus vivendi with Russia about cyber weapons and so forth. I think that's unlikely. Although, Russians have been saying for a number of years that what they want is some rules They want to have a sense of what the rules are and global stability. The problem is that their notion of what the rules ought to be is diametrically opposed to American values about, you know, human rights and you know, self-determination of countries and so forth. So they want us to you know, clearly acknowledge a Russian sphere of influence or area that they're of countries, neighboring countries that they're allowed to dominate. And they want the United States to back off from criticizing human rights violations in Russia. And those are things that are just really hard for Americans to do. It's just really inconsistent with who we are. But if we don't talk about Ukraine too much, don't create additional pressures there, it might be possible for Ukraine and Russia and some of the European countries to work out something along the lines of the Minsk agreements that eventually works to normalize things, right? Maybe eventually there could be a territorial settlement or a treaty between Russia and Ukraine that would prevent a flare-up of additional conflict there. And that seems like the place where conflict between the United States and Russia would be most likely.
Well, I would appreciate your insight, and our audience does as well. Thank you for being generous with your time and flexible this week. It's been an interesting week for sure, and I know there'll be more to discuss with you coming up here. Thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure, Evan.
Randy Stone is the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. You may have more connections coming up in a moment.